Okay, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday afternoon on Chicken Wink Radio. I'm Stephen Robertson. This is Cancel the Cabal. I guess the sound levels seem to be okay. I don't want to turn myself up too high because it overpowers Roger and Luca whenever I talk on theirs. I want to say once again, as I do always try to remember at the beginning of the show, that all the stations are listener supported. Shake and Wake, PSN Radio, EPGN Radio, and SoFlo Radio. So please support the stations if you are able to. I'm going to continue on reading. Hopefully get through this within the next couple of weeks. It looks like I should be able to. Hasn't really been very long since started this book, The Scientific Outlook by Bertrand Russell. Alrighty, that's good. I will go back about half of a paragraph or one paragraph so I can remind myself and everybody else what I'm reading. I hope. Let us make some examples of traditional principles which appear no longer defensible. The first example that occurs to me is as regards the investment of capital. At present, within wide limits, any man who has money to invest may invest it as he chooses. This freedom was defended during the heyday of laissez-faire. That's French. Sometimes I don't know a lot of French words. On the ground that the business which paid best was always the most socially useful. Few men nowadays would dare to maintain such a doctrine. Nevertheless, the old freedom persists. It is clear that in a scientific society, capital would be invested where its social utility is greatest, not where it earns the highest rate of profits. The rate of profits earned depends often upon quite accidental circumstances. Take, for example, the competition between railways and buses. Railways have to pay for their permanent way, while buses do not. It may therefore happen to be the investor may happen that to the investor railways are unprofitable and buses profitable, even when the exact opposite is the case for the community considered as a whole. Or again, considering the profits of those who had the good sense to acquire property in the neighborhood of Millbank Prison shortly before it was turned into a Tate Gallery. The expenditure which brought these men their profits was public expenditure, and their profits afford no evidence that they had invested their money in a manner advantageous to the public. To take a more important illustration, consider the immense sums of money that are spent on advertising. It cannot possibly be maintained that these bring any but the most meager return to the community. The principle of permitting each capitalist to invest his money as he chooses is not, therefore, socially defensible. Take again such a matter as housing. In England, individualism leads most families to prefer a small house of their own rather than an apartment in a large house. The result is that the suburbs of London are spread out through mile after mile of dreariness, to the immense detriment of women and children. Boy, rural life is dreary, isn't it? Each housewife cooks an abominable dinner for a great expenditure of labor for an infuriated husband. Wow. Every husband that lives in the rural is infuriated. Imagine that. The children, when they come home from school, or while they are too young to go to school, find themselves coping in a small, stuffy premises where either they are a nuisance to their parents, or their parents are a nuisance to them. Good grief. This just screams communism, page after page. In a more sensible community, each family would occupy a part of an immense building with a courtyard in the middle. There would be no individual cooking, but only communal meals. Children, as soon as they were no longer at the breast, would spend their day in the large, airy halls under the care of women, possessing the knowledge, the training, and the temperament required for making young children happy. Sounds like utopia, doesn't it? The wives, who at present drudge all day during wasteful work, badly. No, now housewives are stupid too. Stupid and wasteful. Would be set free to earn their living outside the home. The benefit of such a system to the mothers, and still more to the children, would be incalculable. At the Rachel McMillan Nursery School, it was found that about 90% of the children had rickets when they first came, and almost all were cured at the end of the first year in school. In the ordinary home, the necessary modicum of light and air and good food cannot be provided, whereas all these things can be provided quite cheaply if they were provided for many children at once. Yeah, I know, Mom. Makes you mad, doesn't it? Exactly. Bring it back. The freedom to cause one's children to grow up stunted and crippled on the ground that one is too fond of them to part with them is a freedom which is certainly not in the public interest. Take again the question of work, both the kind of work and the method of performing it. At present, young people choose their own trade or profession, usually because at the moment of their choice is, it seems, to afford a good opening. Ugh, these pages. A well-informed person possessed of foresight might know that the particular line in question was going to be a much less profitable a few years hence. In such a case, some public guidance to the young might prove extremely useful. And as regards technical methods, it is seldom in the public interest that an antiquated or wasteful technique should be allowed to persist when a more economical technique is known. At present, owing to the irrational character of the capitalist system, the interest of the individual wage earner is very often opposed to the interest of the community. That's why they call it individualism and collectivism. Basically it right there. At least that's what they taught me in college. At present, owing to the irrational character of the capitalist system, the interest of the individual wage earner is very often opposed to the interest of the community, since economical methods may cause him to lose his job. This is due to the survival of the capitalistic principles in a society which has grown so organic that it ought not to tolerate them. It is obvious that in a well-organized community it should be possible for the large body of individuals to profit by preserving an inefficient technique. It is clear that the use of the most efficient technique should be enforced, and no wage earner should be allowed to suffer by its enforcement. I come now to the matter which touches the individual more intimately. I mean the question of propagation. It has hitherto been considered that any man and woman, not within the prohibited degrees, have a right to marry, and having married, have a right, if not a duty, to have as many children as nature may decree. This is a right which the scientific society of the future is not likely to tolerate. Boy, 1938, he lays it all out right there, doesn't he? In any given state of industrial and agricultural technique, there is an optimum density of population which ensures a greater degree of material well-being. I have to stop and knock because I just had a thought. 1938 is when he wrote this, and 1948 is when the Rothschild dynasty, the Rothschild crime family, and the Rockefellers, 10 years before they helped China overthrow their elected government and went to communism. I'm sure quite a few of their communists read this book. In any given state of industrial and agricultural technique, there is an optimum density of population which ensures a greater degree of material well-being than would result from either an increase or a diminution of numbers. As a general rule, except in new countries, the density of population has been beyond this optimum. Though perhaps France, in recent decades, has been an exception, except where there is property to be inherited, the member of a small family suffers almost as much from overpopulation as a member of a large family. Those who cause overpopulation are therefore doing an injury not only to their own children, but to the community. It may therefore be assumed that society will discourage them if necessary, as soon as religious prejudices no longer stand in the way of such action. The same question will arise in a more dangerous form as between different nations and different races. If a nation finds that it is losing military superiority through a lower birth rate than that of a rival, it may attempt, as has already been done in such cases, to stimulate its own birth rate. But when this provides ineffective, as it probably will, there will be a tendency to demand a limitation in the birth rate of the rival nation. An external government, if it ever comes into being, will have to take account of such matters. And just as there is at present a quota of national immigrants into the United States, so in future there will be a quota of national immigrants into the world. Children in excess of a license figure will presumably be subjected to infanticide. This would be less cruel than the present method, which is to kill them by war or starvation. I am, however, only prophesizing a certain future, not advocating it. I guess there should be a question mark on the end of there, but there's not. There's a period. At least my feeling, there should be a question mark. Quality as well as quantity of population is likely to become a matter for public relation. Sorry, regulation. Already in many states of America, it is permissible to sterilize the mentally defective, and a similar proposal in England is in the domain of practical politics. This is only the first step. As time goes on, we may expect a greater and greater percentage of population to be regarded as mentally defective from the point of view of parenthood. However that may be, it is clear that the parents who have a child, when there is every likelihood it will be, it is every likelihood of its being mentally defective, are doing a wrong both to the child and to the community. No defensible principle of liberty, therefore, stands in the way of preventing them from such behavior. In suggesting any curtailment of liberty, there are always two quite distinct questions to be considered. The first is whether such a curtailment would be in the public interest if it were wisely carried out, and the second is whether it will be in the public interest when it is carried out with a certain measure of ignorance and perversity. I'm going to take a little 10-second break here and get something to drink quick. And hopefully I'll be able to find my spot. I got a good idea where I left off. Yes. These two questions are, in theory, quite distinct. But from the point of view of the government, the second question does not exist, since every government believes it's entirely free from both ignorance and perversity. Every government, consequently, in so far as it is not restrained by traditional prejudices, will advocate more interference with liberty than is wise. When, therefore, it is in this chapter we are considering what interferences with liberty might be theoretically justified. And here we go. We must hesitate to draw the conclusion that they should be advocated in practice. I think it probably, however, that almost all interferences with liberty for which there is a theoretical justification will in time be carried out in practice, because scientific technique is gradually making governments so strong that they need not consider outside opinion. The result of this will be that governments will be able to interfere with individual liberty, however in their opinion there is a sound reason for doing so. And for the reason just given, this will be much more often than it should be. For this reason, scientific technique is likely to lead to a governmental tyranny, which may in time prove disastrous. Yeah. It has proven time and time again for over 6,000 years of recorded history. Equality, like liberty, is difficult to reconcile with scientific technique, since this involves a great apparatus of experts and officials inspiring and controlling vast organizations. Democratic forms may be preserved in politics, but they will not have as much reality as in the community of small peasant proprietors. Officials unavoidably have power, and where many vital questions are so technical that the ordinary man cannot hope to understand them, experts must inevitably acquire a considerable measure of control. Take the question of currency and credit as an example. William Jennings Bryan, it is true, made currency an electoral issue in 1896. But the men who voted for him were men who would have voted for him whether whatever issue he had selected. At the present time, according to many experts who command respect, I'm surprised he didn't say demand respect. Incalculable misery is being caused by a wrong handling of a question of currency and credit. But it is impossible to submit this question to the electorate, except in some passionate and unscientific form. The only way in which anything can be done is to convince the officials who control the great central banks. So long as these men act honestly and in accordance with tradition, the community cannot control them, since if they are taken, very few people will know it. To take a less important illustration, anyone who has ever compared British and American methods of handling goods, traffic on airways, knows that the American method is infinitely superior. There are no private trucks, and the trucks of the railways are of standard size, capable of carrying 40 tons. In England, everything is higgledy-piggledy and unsystematic. I'd never heard that phrase before, those two words in a phrase. Higgledy-piggledy, that's what it is. And unsystematic. And the use of private trucks caused great waste. If this were put right, freights could be reduced and consumers would benefit. But this is not a matter upon which elections can be fought, since there would be no obvious gain either to railway companies or to railway workers. If a more uniform system is imposed, it will be done not as a result of democratic demand, but by government officials. The scientific society will be just as oligarchic under socialism or communism as under capitalism. For even where the forms of democracy exist, they cannot supply the ordinary voter with the requisite knowledge, nor enable him to be on the spot at the crucial moment. The men who understand the complicated mechanism of a modern community and who have the habit of initiative and decision must inevitably control the course of events to a very great extent. Perhaps this is even more true in a socialistic state than in any other, for in a socialistic state, economic and political power are centralized in the same hands. It would, I'm sure I've said this quite a few times on air, but, you know, socialism or communism looks really fantastic on paper, but no state has ever done anything like that. They still have crony capitalism or crony socialism, whatever you want to call it. Still a very few filthy hands get their way. For a socialistic state, economic and political power are concentrated in the same hands, and the national organization of the economic life is more complete than in a state where private enterprise exists. Moreover, a socialistic state is likely to have more perfect control than any other over the organs of publicity and propaganda, so that it will have more power of causing men to know what it wishes known and not to know what it wishes unknown. Equality, therefore, like liberty, is, I fear, no more than a 19th century dream. The world of the future will contain a governing class, probably not hereditary, but more analogous to the government of the Catholic Church. All roads still lead to Rome, folks. And this governing class is as it acquires increasing knowledge and confidence, will interfere more and more with the life of the individual, and will learn more and more the technique of causing this interference to be tolerated. It may be assumed that their purposes will be excellent and their conduct honorable. It may be assumed that they will be informed and industrious. But it cannot, I think, be assumed that they will be, that they will abstain from the exercise of power merely on the ground that individual initiative is a good thing, or on the ground that an oligarchy is unlikely to consider the true interest of its slaves. For men capable of such self-restraint will not rise to positions of power which, except when they are hereditary, are attained only by those who are energetic and untroubled by doubt. What sort of world will such a governing class produce? In the following chapters, I shall hazard a guess at some part to the end of the answer. Well, that was perfect timing. The end of that chapter, right at the break. Let's see, I guess about maybe about 6 minutes, everyone. Be right back.
This song is for all of those whose names are there, and for all of those who risked having their names there on the wall.
Just can't be.
Okay, welcome back, everyone. We are into chapter... Chapter 14. XIV. That's 14, I believe. Scientific government. When I speak of scientific government, I ought, perhaps, to explain what I mean by the term. I do not mean simply a government composed of men of science. There were many men of science in the government of Napoleon, including Laplace, who, however, proved so incompetent that he had to be dismissed in a very short time. I should not consider Napoleon's government scientific while it contained Laplace, or unscientific when it lost him. I should define a government as in a greater or less degree scientific in proportion as it can produce intended results. The greater the number of results that is can be intended and produce, and more scientific it is. The framers of the American Constitution, for example, were scientific in safeguarding private property, but unscientific in attempting to introduce a system of indirect election for the presidency. The governments which made the First World War were unscientific, since they all fell during the course of it. There was, however, one exception, namely Serbia, which was completely scientific, and as a result of the war was exactly what was intended by the Serbian government, which was in power at the time of the Sarajevo murders. Owing to the increase of knowledge, it is possible for governments nowadays to achieve many more intended results than were possible in former times, and it is likely that before very long, results which even now are impossible will become possible. Total abolition of property, for example, is at the present moment technically possible. That is to say, known methods of production, if wisely organized, would suffice to produce enough goods to keep the whole population of the globe in tolerable comfort. But although this is technically possible, it is not yet psychologically possible. International competition, class antagonisms, and anarchic system of private enterprise stand in the way, and to remove these obstacles is no light task. The diminution of disease is a purpose which in Western nations encounters fewer obstacles, and has therefore been more successfully pursued. But to this purpose also there are great obstacles throughout Asia. Eugenics, except in the form of sterilization of the feeble-minded, is not yet practical politics, but may become so within the next 50 years. As we have already seen, it may be superseded when embryology is more advanced by direct methods of operating upon the fetus. All of these are things which, as soon as they become clearly feasible, will make a great appeal to eugenic and practical idealists. Most idealists are a mixture of two types, which may call respectively the dreamer and the manipulator. The pure dreamer is a lunatic. The pure manipulator is a man who cares only for the personal power. But the idealist lives in an intermediate position between these two extremes. Sometimes the dreamer preponderates, sometimes a manipulator. William Morris found pleasure in dreaming of news from nowhere. Lenin found to satisfaction until he could clothe his ideas in the garment of reality. Both types of idealistic desire a world different from that which they find themselves. But the manipulator feels strong enough to create it, while the dreamer, feeling baffled, takes refuge in fantasy. In this, the manipulative type of idealist will create the scientific society. Of such men in our own day, Lenin is the archetype. The manipulative idealist differs from the man who merely personal ambition by the fact that he desires not only certain things for himself, but a certain kind of society. Cromwell would not have been content to have been Lord Lieutenant of Ireland in succession to Stratford, or Archbishop to Canterbury in succession to land. It was essential to this happiness that England should be a certain sort of country, not merely that he should be prominent in it. It is this element of impersonal desire which distinguishes the idealist from other men. For men of this type, there had been in Russia since the Revolution more scope than any other country at any other time. And the more scientific technique is perfected, the more scope there will be for them every day, everywhere. I fully expect, therefore, that men of this sort will have a predominant part to play in molding the world during the next 200 years. The attitude of which may be called practical idealists among men of science at the present day towards problems of government is very clearly set forth in the leading article in Nature, September 6, 1930, from which the following are extracts. Among the changes which the British Association for the Advancement of Science has witnessed since its formation in 1831 is the gradual disappearance of demarcation between science and industry. As Lord Melchett pointed out in a recent address, the endeavor to distinguish between pure and applied science has now lost any kind of meaning. No clear distinction is possible between science and industry. The results of search work of the most speculative character often lead to outstanding practical results. Such progressive firms as Imperial Chemical Industries Limited, now following Great Britain, the practice long current in Germany, by forcing close contact with the scientific research work of the universities. If, however, it is true that in the last 25 years, science has rapidly assured the responsibility of leadership in industry, a yet wider responsibility is now demanded of it. Under the conditions of modern civilization, the community in general, as well as industry, is dependent upon pure and applied science for its continued progress and prosperity. Under the influence of modern scientific discoveries and their applications, not only in industry, but as in many other directions, the whole basis of society is rapidly becoming scientific. And to an increasing extent, the problems which confront the national administrator, whether judiciary or executive, involve factors which require scientific knowledge for their solution. In recent years, the rapid growth and the rate of all kinds of international communication and transport has forced on industry an outlook and organization that is astonishing extent and are international. These same forces have, however, enlarged the bounds within which mistaken policies can exert their ill effects. Recent historical research has demonstrated that the difficult racial problems confronting the Union of South Africa today are the result of mistaken policies determined by political prejudices three generations ago. In the modern world, the dangers arising from mistakes caused by prejudice and neglect of impartial or scientific inquiry are infinitely more serious. In an age where nearly all the problems of administration and development involve scientific factors, civilization cannot afford to leave administrative control in the hands of those who have no first-hand knowledge of science. Under modern conditions, therefore, more is required of scientific workers than the mere enlargement of the bounds of knowledge. They can no longer be content to allow others to take the results of their discoveries and use them unguided. Scientific workers must accept responsibility for the control of the forces which they have been released by their work. Without their help, efficient administration and a high degree of statesmanship are virtually impossible. The practical problem of establishing a right relationship between science and politics, between knowledge and power, or more precisely between the scientific worker and the control and administration of the life of the community, is one of the most difficult confronting democracy. The community is, however, entitled to expect from members of the British Association some consideration of such a problem and some guidance as to the means by which science can assume its place of leadership. It is significant that, in contrast to the relative importance of scientific workers in national affairs, in the international sphere, advisory committees of experts have, since the World War, exerted a remarkable and effective influence. Even when devoid of their legislative authority, two committees of experts organized by the League of Nations and exercising advisory functions only is due the credit of the schemes which were successful in rescuing a European state from bankruptcy and chaos, and in handling an unemployment scheme which settled 1.5 million refugees, following upon the greatest migration in history. These examples sufficiently demonstrate that, given the requisite stimulus and enthusiasm, a scientific expert can already exert an effective influence when normal administrative effort has failed, and when indeed, as is the case of Australia, the problem had been dismissed by statesmen as hopeless. In truth, scientific workers occupy a privileged position in society as well as industry, and there are welcome signs that this is now recognized by scientific workers themselves. Thus, in this presidential address to the Chemical Society last year, Professor Jocelyn Thorpe suggested that the age is at hand in which the changing majorities of governments will no longer be able to determine major policies, except in directions approved by organized industry. There we go. And in advocating the closer organization of science and industry, stress the political strength to be obtained thereby. The paper to be read before the British Association on the screening of South End from gunfire. Is further evidence that scientific workers are exceptional. And responsibility of leadership it matters of social and industry safety. Therefore, inspiration or encouragement with meetings of the British Association may give to scientific workers in the prosecution of their researches. There is no way in which the association can be fittingly serve humanity than by calling scientific workers to accept those wide responsibilities of leadership and association as well as the industry, which their own efforts have made them inevitably lot. It will be seen from the above that men of science are becoming conscious of the responsibility towards society conferred by their knowledge and are feeling it a duty to make a larger part and to take a larger part in the direction of public affairs than they have hitherto done. The man who dreams of a scientifically organized world and wishes to translate his dreams into practice finds himself faced with many obstacles. There is the opposition of inertia and habit. People wish to continue behaving as they always have behaved and living as they always have lived. There is the opposition of vested interest. An economic system inherited with feudal times gives advantages to men who have done nothing to deserve them, and these men, being rich and powerful, are able to place formidable obstacles in the way of fundamental change. In addition to these forces, there are also hostile idealisms. Christian ethics is in certain fundamental respects opposed to the scientific ethic, which is gradually growing up. Christianity emphasizes the importance of an individual soul and is not prepared to sanction the sacrifice of an innocent man for the sake of some ulterior good to the majority. Christianity as a word is unpolitical, as is nature, since it grew up among men devoid of political power. The new ethic, which is gradually growing in connection with scientific technique, will have its eye upon society rather than upon the individual. It will have little use for the superstition of guilt and punishment, but will be prepared to make individuals suffer for the public good without inventing reasons purporting to show that they deserve to suffer. In this sense, it will be ruthless and, according to traditional ideals, immoral. But the change will have to come about naturally through the habit of viewing society as a whole rather than as a collection of individuals. We view a human body as a whole, and if, for example, it is necessary to amputate a limb, we do not consider it necessary to prove first that the limb is wicked. Tired of these pages. They're getting harder the farther I go along. We consider the good of the whole body a quite sufficient argument. Similarly, the man who thinks of society as a whole will sacrifice a member of society for the good of the whole, without much consideration for that individual's welfare. This has always been the practice in war, because war is the collective enterprise. Soldiers are exposed to the risk of death for the public good. Although no one suggests that they deserve death, but men have not hitherto attached the same importance to social purposes other than war, and have therefore shrunk from inflicting sacrifices which were felt to be unjust. I think it probable that the scientific idealist of the future will be free from this scruple, not only in time of war, but in time of peace also. In overcoming the possibilities, they will find themselves organized in the oligarchy of opinion such as is formed by the Communist Party in the USSR. But the reader will say, how is all this to come about? It is not merely a fantasy of fantasy of wish fulfillment, utterly remote from political politics. I do not think so. The future which I foresee is, to begin with, only very partially in agreement with my own wishes. I find pleasure in splendid individuals rather than in powerful organizations, and I fear that the place for a splendid individual will be much more restricted in the future than in the past. Apart from this purely personal opinion, it is easy to imagine ways in which the world might acquire a scientific government such as I am supposing. It is clear that the next world war if it does not end in a draw, will give world supremacy to either Russia or the United States. In this way, the world government will come about, in which the men in supreme control will have a delegate, much of their power to experts of various types. It may be assumed that in time the supreme rulers, having become soft, will grow lazy. Like the Merovingian kings, they will allow their powers to be usurped by the less lordly experts, and gradually these experts will come to form the real government in the world, of the world. I imagine them forming a close corporation, regulated partly by opinion, so long as their government is challenged, but chosen later on by means of examinations, intelligence tests, and a test of willpower. I guess that's another good place for a break here. Yeah, every page just keeps getting worse and worse, Annie. Sticks harder and harder because they're getting flimsier and they're still sticking. Getting less and less pages. They're sticking more and more. I think about 6.5 minute break here, everyone, so be right back.
I come to the garden alone, while the dew is still on the roses, and the voice I hear falling on my ear, the sun. Yeah.
Okay, welcome back, everyone, to the final hour of the show. And once again, if you're capable of donating to any of the networks, please do. I'm sure Andy would appreciate it. I'm sure that the others would too. Yeah, already. The Society of Experts, which I am imagining will embrace all eminent men of science, except a few wrong-headed and anarchical cranks. You're a crank. Wrong-headed crank if you don't believe science. It will possess the sole up-to-date armaments and will be the repository of all new secrets in the art of war. There will therefore be no more war, since resistance by the unscientific will be doomed to obvious failure. The Society of Experts will control propaganda and education. Ooh. It will teach loyalty to the world government and make nationalism high treason. The government being an oligarchy, will instill submissiveness into the great bulk of the population, confining initiative and the habit of command to its own members. It is possible that it may invent ingenious ways of concealing its own power, leaving the forms of democracy intact, and allowing the plutocrats or politicians to imagine that they are cleverly controlling these forms. Yep, that's been done. It's been done. Gradually, however, the plutocrats become stupid through laziness. They will lose their wealth. It will pass more and more into public ownership and be controlled by the government of experts. Thus, however, the outward forms may be, all real power will come to be concentrated into the hands of these who understand the art of scientific manipulation. All this is, of course, a fancy picture, and whatever really happens in the future is likely to be something which cannot be foreseen. It may be that a scientific civilization will be found essentially unstable. There are several reasons which make this a not unplausible view. The most obvious of these is war. It happens that recent innovations in the art of war have increased the power of the attack much more than the power of defense. And there seems no likely that the arts of defense will be able to recover lost ground before the next great war. If that is so, the only hope for the survival of civilization is that some one nation will be sufficiently remote from the theater of operations and sufficiently strong to emerge with this social structure undestroyed. The United States and Russia are the only two nations that have the responsible chance of occupying the position. If these two nations share the universal disintegration, which the next war is almost certain to produce in Europe, it is likely to be many centuries before civilization returns to its present level. Even if America survives intact, it will be necessary to set about at once organizing the world government. Since civilization could not be expected to survive the shock of yet another world war, in such circumstances, the most important force on the side of civilization will be the desire of American investors to find safe investments in the devastated countries of the old world. Should they be content with investments in their own continent, the outlook would be black indeed. Another reason for doubting the stability of the scientific civilization is to be derived from the fall of the birth rate. The most intelligent classes and the most scientific nations are dying out. And the Western nations as a whole do not do much more than reproducing their own numbers. Do not do much more than reproduce their own numbers. Unless very radical measures are adopted, the white population of the globe will soon begin to diminish. The French have already been led to depend upon African troops. And if the white population dwindles, there will be an increasingly tendency to leave the rough work to the men of other races. In the long run, this will lead to mutinies and reduce Europe to the condition of Haiti. In such circumstances, it would be left to the Chinese to carry out on our scientific civilization. But in proportion as they acquire it, they too will acquire a lowered birth rate. It is therefore impossible for a scientific civilization to be stable unless artificial methods are adapted for stimulating breeding. There are more powerful obstacles in the way of adoption of such methods, both financial and sentimental. In this matter, it is a matter of war. Unscientific civilization will have to become more scientific if it is to escape destruction. Whether it will become more scientific with sufficient rapidity, it is impossible to foresee. We have seen that scientific civilization demands worldwide organization if it is to be stable. We have considered the possibility of such an organization in matters of government. We shall now consider it in the economic sphere. At present, production is organized, as far as possible, nationally by means of tariff walls. Every nation tries to produce at home as much as possible of the goods that it consumes. This tendency is on the increase, and even Great Britain, which formerly aimed at maximizing its exports by means of free trade, has abandoned this policy in favor of the comparative economic isolation. It is, of course, clear that a purely economic point of view, from a purely economic point of view, it is wasteful to organize production nationally rather than internationally. It would be an economy if all the motor cars used throughout the world were manufactured in Detroit. That is to say, a car of given excellence could be produced with less expense of human labor in that case than it can at present. In a world scientifically organized, most industrial products would be thus localized. There would be one place for making pens and needles, another place for making scissors and knives, another place for making airplanes, and yet another for agricultural machinery. When, if ever, the world government that we have considered comes into being, one of its first tasks will be the international organization of production. Production will no longer be left. I don't know who that is. Gotta get rid of him. Hang on a second here. Sorry, I got a block. I think it was one of those trolls or something. Sorry about that. Now I gotta find where I was at. That is to say, a car of given excellence could be produced with less expense of human labor in that case than in can in present. In a world scientifically organized, more industrial products would be thus localized. There would be one place for making pins and needles, another place for making scissors and knives, another place for making airplanes, and yet another for agricultural machinery. When, if any, the world government that we have considered comes into being, one of its first tasks will be the international organization of production. Production will no longer be left, as at present, to private enterprise, but will be undertaken solely in accordance with government orders. This is already the case in which such things as battleships, because in regard to war efficiency, is thought to be more important, but in most matters production is left to the chaotic impulses of private manufacturers, who can make much of these things and little, and too little of others, with the result that there is poverty in the midst of unused plenty. The industrial plant of at present existing in the world is in many directions far in excess of the world's needs. By eliminating competition and concentrating production in a single concern, all this waste could be avoided. The control of raw materials is a matter which any scientific society would be governed by a central authority. At present, the most important raw materials are controlled by military power. The weak nation possessed of oil soon finds itself under the scrutiny. Suzerainty? Suzerainty? Never seen that word. Of some strong nation. The Transvaal lost its independence because it contained gold. Raw materials ought not to belong to those who, by conquest or diplomacy, have happened to acquire. Have happened to acquire the territory in which they are. They ought to belong to the world authority, which would ration them to those who had the most skill in utilizing them. Moreover, our present economic system causes everybody to be wasteful of raw materials since there is no motive for foresight. In the scientific world, the supply of any vital raw material will be carefully estimated. And as the moment of its exhaustion approaches, scientific research will be directed to the discovery of a substitute. But uranium and thorium, or any other raw material suitable for generating atomic energy, should be retained in the hands of the international authority. Agriculture, for reasons which we consider in an earlier chapter, may have less importance in the future than it has at present, and has had in the past. We shall have not only artificial silk, but artificial wool, and artificial timber, and artificial rubber. In time, we may have artificial food. Yeah, in time. But in the meantime, agriculture will become more and more industrialized, both in its methods and in the mentality of those who practice it. American and Canadian agriculturists have already the industrial mentality, not the mentality of the patient peasant. Machinery will, of course, be increasingly employed. In the neighborhood of large urban markets, extensive cultivation and artificial methods of warming the soil will yield many crops every year. Here and there throughout the countryside there will be large power stations forming the nucleus around which the population will cluster. Our agricultural mentality, as it has been known since ancient times, nothing will survive since the soil and even the climate will be subject to human control. Yes, we now have everything in this book. Everything, Sarah. Every single thing. It may be assumed that every man and woman will be obliged to work and will be taught a new trade if, for any reason, work at the old trade is no longer required. The peasant test work, of course, will be that which gives the most control over the mechanism. The post giving more power will presumably be awarded to the ablest men as a result of intelligence test. For entirely inferior work, Negroes will be employed wherever possible. One may, I suppose, assume that the most desirable kinds of work will be more highly paid than the less desirable kinds, since they will require more skill. The society will not be one in which there is equality, although I doubt whether the inequalities will be hereditary, except as between different races, i.e. between white and colored labor. Everybody will be comfortable, and those who occupy the better paid post will be able to enjoy considerable luxury. There will not be, as at present, fluctuations of good and bad times, for these were merely the result of our anarchic economic system. Nobody will starve, and nobody will suffer the economic anxieties which at present beset rich and poor alike. On the other hand, life will be destitute as adventure except for the most highly paid experts. Ever since civilization began, men have been seeking security more avidly than they have sought anything else. In such a world, they will have it, but I am not quite sure whether they will think it worth the price that they will have paid for it.
That's going to get cold. Try some of them biscuits.
Sorry about that. Seems my dinner is ready, so I guess I'm done here. We're going into chapter 15 next week. That's called Education in the Scientific Society. So, more communism next week, everyone. I'm not going to waste any time putting a song on Annie, so I'm just going to drop the stream and say thanks, everyone. As you probably heard, my dinner's getting cold. So I'll see everyone tomorrow with me and Roger.